The U.S. says it has no plan to ease sanctions before possible talks with Iran and major powers, while Tehran has repeatedly said Washington should lift sanctions first. Human Rights Watch says Indian authorities have adopted laws and policies that systematically discriminate against Muslims and stigmatize critics of the government. Also coming up, the UN Children's Fund says several million children are at risk in the Democratic Republic of Congo regions destabilized by armed groups. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour. The new U.S. president says his administration is ready to re-engage in negotiations on Iran's nuclear program with the signatories of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA.
We're prepared to re-engage in negotiations with the P5 plus one on Iran's nuclear program. We must also address Iran's destabilizing activities across the Middle East. And we're going to work in close cooperation with our European and other partners as we proceed.
Biden made the remarks in the virtual Munich Security Conference. Separately, a White House spokeswoman said Washington has no plan to ease sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Jen Psaki said the U.S. would not issue an executive order about returning to the nuclear deal before possible talks with Iran and the major powers. Tehran has repeatedly said Washington should lift sanctions on Iran first so that the country would resume some of its nuclear commitments that have been suspended as per the terms of the JCPOA. Meanwhile, the United Nations has expressed support for efforts that would lead to the full implementation of the nuclear deal. Political commentator Margaret Flowers says the Biden administration should own up to the fact that it was Washington that withdrew from the JCPOA and reimposed sanctions on Iran.
You're well aware that the United States foreign policy doesn't really vary much between presidents, even when we change the major political party that's in power. The fact that he's saying that he's ready to renegotiate, re-engage with Iran, I think is possibly a sign that he's feeling some pressure from people within the United States. But I don't, you know, just looking at the language, talking about Iran's destabilizing efforts in the Middle East, you know, what he's saying there is that Iran is interfering with the United States foreign policy goals in the Middle East. And this is what's, you know, considered to be a problem for the United States. So I think that the United States needs to own up to the fact that it was the U.S. that withdrew from the agreement, that it was the U.S. that went back on its commitments, and, you know, in good faith and in good effort, you know, we should be making an offer of ending the sanctions, which are illegal, they are against international law, and they're causing great harm during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Human Rights Watch accuses Indian authorities of adopting laws and policies that systematically discriminate against Muslims and stigmatize government critics. In a report, the leading rights group said the prejudices embedded in the government of the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party have infiltrated independent institutions. This, the report said, has enabled nationalist groups to threaten, harass, and attack religious minorities with impunity. The report comes ahead of the first anniversary of communal violence in Delhi that killed 53 people, mostly Muslims. The deadly attacks followed months of peaceful protests by Indians of all faiths against the government's discriminatory policies, including a controversial citizenship law. Rohingya refugees living in camps across India have been terrified amid renewed fears that the government may arrest them for illegally entering the country. Scores of them have been arrested since last month, as Munawar Zaman reports this has triggered panic among the community.
In this Rohingya refugee camp in the outskirts of New Delhi, there is an utter panic and the residents are fearful. even going out to buy the essentials. They say many are chased, intimidated, and usually police and other agencies visit their camps to monitor their movements. Ali Johar, a young Rohingya refugee, says several have been arrested in the recent months and put into jails for illegally entering India, saying the whole community is in utter despair.
Around 60 people have been arrested in the different parts of India, including West Bengal, Manipur, Assam, Haryana, and Delhi. In Delhi, around 8 people were detained. In Haryana, several families were harassed to leave out from Haryana.
Fearful of possible arrest and expulsion, scores of refugees have gone into hiding across the Indian subcontinent, while others have entered Bangladesh amid a mounting hate campaign against the community in India. The destitute community who has escaped what the United Nations described genocide is struggling for existence amid international silence about their plight. An estimated 40,000 are living in India. The community has faced a brutal crackdown by the army in their country, such as rape, murder, child killings, arbitrary arrests, forced disappearances, as well as destruction of the entire Rohingya villages. Now many fear that the military coup might make the situation even worse. Some reports suggest hundreds of Rohingya are being held in Indian jails on charges of illegal entry and have no proper judicial support. Their men are unable to find work due to lack of identity cards and threats of intimidation by law enforcement agencies forcing men to stay at their camps.
We have been living here peacefully since 2012. We came to save our lives, but the police and other agencies are usually coming to our camps for questioning, asking our IDs, and this has become a routine. We are terrified and we can't even sleep, thinking what would happen to us.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion, while the government describes them as security threat. Observers say the Rohingya refugees in particular have in the past and present been used largely for political reasons in this part of the world. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The U.S. Children's Agency says several million children are at risk in parts of the Democratic Republic of the Congo that have been destabilized by armed groups. In a statement, UNICEF said that the lives and futures of more than 3 million displaced children are at risk in the country while the world is looking the other way. According to UN figures, some 5.2 million people in the DRC have been forced to flee their homes because of conflict. The statement said displaced families live in overcrowded settlements that lack safe water, health care, and other basic services. The DRC is grappling with numerous conflicts, especially in the remote east. Political commentator Robert Patillo says the entire world has been turning a blind eye to the current violation of human rights in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Over 5 million people have been displaced. Over 3 million children primarily have been displaced by violence throughout the region. What we've seen is reports of recruitment of child soldiers, people being enslaved, sexual assault against young women and girls. And this is one of the worst human rights abuses currently going on planet Earth. And the entire planet seems to be turning a blind eye to it. This is not anything new, however. We've seen since rapid decolonization in the 1960s, the nature of democratic systems within recently decolonized regions has been unstable because you still have the hands of Europe and the U.S. and China interfering on local economic and foreign affairs, which has destabilized the region, destabilized these nations, and caused this infighting. So I think what the Western powers have to do, and as well China, since they have such a large imprint on the continent, is work together collaboratively with the leadership on the ground to bring an end to these. But we have to bring international attention to the issue. Otherwise, there will be no remedy for the 5 million plus people who have been displaced.
Welcome back. The leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement says the country's offensive on the city of Ma'rib is aimed at driving out, quote, Saudi-backed aggressors and their backers. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the enemies of Yemen are trying to bring the nation under their yoke. However, he stressed that the Yemenis will not be controlled by Riyadh, Washington or Israel. The Ansar Allah leader added that the people of his country will continue to fight for their freedom. The remarks come as Ansar Allah is carrying out an operation to take control of Ma'rib, the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen. Sana'a has accused the militants of using civilians as human shields to hold back the Ansar Allah troops. Meanwhile, the Yemenis have gathered in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a to renew their demands for the international community to release detained oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition. The detention of the vessels has left the impoverished nation with a harsh fuel crisis. Abdul Latif al-Washadi has more in this report.
Yemenis have come together before the UN office in Sana'a to call on the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition into releasing detained oil vessels. The detention of oil vessels has left the country in desperate struggle to survive amid a harsh shortage of fuel.
We have lots of problems amid fuel shortage. We stay here for days to get some liters of gasoline due to the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition and the continued detention of oil ships. We call on those who are after making concessions against the enemies to stand firm when it comes to the basic needs of Yemeni people.
Major sectors including health have warned that they may collapse in a few days if the detained oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition are not immediately released. Thousands of facilities have already stopped providing services due to a lack of fuel.
The situation today is entirely catastrophic, especially in the health sector. The petroleum company is unable to provide health facilities with the oil derivatives. 50 days have passed and not even a lift has been allowed to enter the port of Hodeidah. The U.S. and the U.N. bear responsibility of what is happening in Yemen.
The Saudi-led coalition is still holding 14 Yemeni oil ships illegally as they were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. Hundreds of cars take days in long lines in front of the only working gas station in Sana'a. Yemenis say overcoming this dire situation needs a real action by the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Turning to other news now, NATO says Western governments and their allies need to collaborate more closely to counter, quote, the security consequences of China's rise.
China and Russia are trying to rewrite the rules of the road to benefit their own interests. The rise of China is a defining issue for the transatlantic community, with potential consequences for our security, our prosperity, and our way of life. This is why NATO should deepen our relationships with close partners like Australia and Japan. We also need to invest to maintain our technological.
Stoltenberg made the call in the first meeting between US President Joe Biden and other NATO leaders. Former President Donald Trump had called the military alliance obsolete. During Friday's virtual meeting, Biden reversed that position, calling for a united front with the European Union against China and Russia.
We have to push back against the Chinese government's economic abuses and coercion that undercut the foundations of the international economic system. Everyone must play by the same rules. Russian leaders want people to think that our system is more corrupt or as corrupt as theirs. Putin seeks to weaken the European project and our NATO alliance. He wants to undermine the transatlantic unity and our resolve.
Biden also touted the Western democracy as a system to maintain against what he called those who monopolize and normalize repression. He pointed to the policies of China and Russia against anti-government protesters. Beijing and Moscow say the protests are fueled by foreign powers and have called on the U.S. to stop interfering in their internal affairs. Political analyst Wilmer Leon says the U.S. president tried to blur the line between military and economic tensions with China by dragging NATO into the latter.
Biden is calling upon NATO to deal with China and Russia, but let's just start with China. This is an economic issue, not a military issue. And NATO is an intergovernmental military alliance that was formed in 1949. Why would NATO be getting involved in what is really an economic fight? And so the answer, I think, is because the United States has no answer to China's economic prowess. And all the United States has is a military response based upon the military-industrial complex. So if your only weapon is a hammer, every problem is a nail. And this is all the United States has. Remember, Japan was in a similar position after World War II. Japan's economy grew to prominence with Toyota and its car manufacturing and Sony and its electronic manufacturing. And the United States did the same thing to Japan that it's now trying to do to China, but China isn't going to fall for it.
The Barcelona Public Prosecutor's Office has opened an investigation into a potential hate speech campaign against Muslims in Catalonia led by Spain's far-right party Vox. The investigation follows a denunciation by leaders of the Muslim community in the Spanish northeastern region. José Cadri reports from Catalonia.
The prosecutor's office against hate crimes in Barcelona says it sees sufficient evidence to investigate Spain's far right for allegedly inciting hatred against Muslims following a complaint by several Muslim communities in Catalonia. At the core of the controversy is a video published online by the nativist ultra-nationalist party Vox during the recent election campaign in Catalonia.
The video falsely claims the entire Muslim community in Catalonia is responsible for the 2017 terrorist attacks in Barcelona. It purportedly shows footage of women in burqas in mosques that was actually shot in Afghanistan and other countries.
Vox's Twitter account was temporarily suspended at the end of January for breaching the company's hate speech regulations with false accusations and unfounded claims against Muslims in Catalonia.
Their strategy is to polarize society, to create fear and manipulate that fear in order to antagonize communities. This is an old mechanism that underlies all forms of racism. It alienates others by labeling them as foreigners. It goes back centuries in the Iberian Peninsula, and that is where you need to start in order to understand the rise of Islamophobia in Spain.
Vox won 11 seats in Catalonia's regional parliament. Their aggressive campaign against Muslims has raised awareness among community leaders to re-examine their alliances.
We regret the silence of political parties in Catalonia in this election. While they all wooed Muslim voters, not a single one had the courage to stand up and denounce the Islamophobic, xenophobic attacks against our country.
Although Catalonia is home to nearly 500,000 Muslims and has elected its first Muslim female member of parliament in 2017, it does not have a central cultural center or great mosque to this day.
Unlike in previous suits against the far right, representatives of the Muslim community in Catalonia say they believe they have a solid case against Vox. They trust the courts will do them justice this time around. Kusai Kadri, Barcelona.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
As the world nears the one-year mark from when the coronavirus outbreak was officially declared a pandemic, a United Nations envoy raised alarm about the looming threat of food shortages, explaining that many problems, which experts warned about in the early days of the crisis, have been deferred rather than resolved. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, More Challenging This Year Than Last. UN envoy warns global food crisis getting worse, not better. Stay tuned for the details, please. As the world nears the one-year mark from when the coronavirus outbreak was officially declared a pandemic, a United Nations envoy raised alarm about the looming threat of food shortages, explaining that many problems which experts warned about in the early days of the crisis have been deferred rather than resolved. We are facing a greater threat this year as economies have shrunk. Agnes Kalibata, Special Envoy to the UN Secretary General for the Food Systems Summit 2021, told The Guardian in an exclusive interview. That is happening across the globe everywhere. Countries are in a very distressed situation, and it is not getting easier. It is getting more difficult. Some countries have hung on, but for how long? Though food chain supply issues and increased demand for hunger relief have impacted countries around the world, including the United States of America, during the pandemic, Kalibata highlighted rising prices in Thailand and various African countries. She is president of the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, AGRA, which has earned her some criticism, and formerly served as Rwanda's Minister of Agriculture. The UN experts said that in the face of the public health crisis, the past year many countries used whatever opportunity they had to keep their food systems going. Alongside a COVID-19 death toll that keeps climbing despite multiple vaccines, the price of food is increasing in some cases very fast, which is really challenging. As the coronavirus pandemic and the global economic crisis it has provoked continue, more countries are likely to be drawn into difficulties, added Kalibata. We have not been able to strengthen our reserves. Now they are under pressure. In other words, she said, food is looking more challenging this year than last year. Kalibata, whose comments come ahead of a food system summit expected in September, emphasized the importance of making food both accessible by continuing to move it from where it's produced to where it's distributed, and affordable, especially considering that people worldwide are still losing jobs and income. The economy is shrinking and that it is impacting millions of people, she said, encouraging governments to stay vigilant amid vaccine rollouts. Social protection is very important. We also need to keep prices down. We need to keep food available and we need to strengthen markets, ensure markets are working despite the crisis, she added. Echoing a wide range of experts throughout the pandemic, such as renowned primatologist and conservationist Jane Goodall, who declared in June that we have brought this on ourselves because of our absolute disrespect for animals and environment, Kalibata also called for learning from how humanity's destruction of nature has heightened the threat posed by zoonotic diseases, saying that we need to look at how we as human beings manage the planet. The Guardian's report came on the heels of an opinion piece Kalibata wrote recently for DevEx, a media platform for the global development community, arguing that global food systems can only be truly transformed with a people's summit. In anticipation of the September event, the planning for which preceded the pandemic, Kalibata made the case that countries, governments, and the public need to transform the way they engage with and think about entire food systems, recognizing that current systems don't work for many, especially the world's most marginalized and vulnerable. She wrote that not only does the planet need improved policies, markets, and processes, it also needs new mechanisms for developing this reimagined system from the first seed to the last spoonful. Looking ahead to what she called a make-or-break year, Kalibata also reflected on success stories during the pandemic, pointing to crowdsourced meals and mock COP26 talks by youth climate activists as a source of hope for what can be achieved when people around the world are enabled and encouraged to join forces for good. Making global food systems more inclusive, nutritious, sustainable, and resilient, she explained, requires participation from public and private sectors, companies and consumers, authorities and individuals who are all willing to share platforms, ideas, and learnings on a global level like never before. To that end, she noted, the Food System Summit dialogues, as well as a network of food systems champions and heroes, to advocate not only for better food systems, but for better and greater engagement from everyone. So in 2021, I hope to see governments working more closely with the private sector and taking on recommendations on how to manage trade-offs, including repurposing agricultural subsidies toward producing healthier and more sustainable food, she wrote. Retailers and consumers also have a responsibility to reduce food waste, and civil society can be an engine of engagement better to drive progress, unquote.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and here is a beautiful maxim to start the day from the Holy Prophet's 10th infallible heir, Imam Ali al-Naghi al-Hadi, peace be upon him. Buffoonery is the amusement of the fool, and the action of the ignorant.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in gharn mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. And I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. Once again, I'm joined by my good friend and expert guest, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on this program. I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to this program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much, sir, for being with us once again and accepting our invitation. Sir, we're going to speak about unity. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. I remember some very beautiful things that he was saying about, you know, the unity of the Ummah. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about, you know, not being Sunni or Shia, but being Muslim, and, you know, going to each other's mosques and being with each other, praying with each other. We even see that in Iraq even today, that they're, you know, because of the violence from the Takfiris, we even see the Sunnis and Shias now even praying together and being martyred together.
Exactly.
In the mosques, you know, these horrible car bombs that go off in Baghdad. You know, we're seeing that all the time, these horrific scenes where Muslims are being slaughtered during prayer, which, you know, leaves one, you know, wondering, you know, exactly, you know, what's going on. But the Imam, as I say, may God bless his great soul, emphasized this unity a great deal, and we see the need for this unity every day and every moment. So, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, without further ado, I leave the stage entirely to you to give us your take on that.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what you've mentioned is exactly, you know, the important point, which is that you have an Islamic leader with all those things that we've talked about so many times, and all those important matters, both religiously and also politically and globally. And one of his main points and one of the things that he emphasizes repeatedly is Islamic unity.
Yes.
Now, this is a man who is a, as we've mentioned many times before, a clergy and a scholar and somebody who is completely and 100% coming out of the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
So one might think, if one doesn't really know the school of Ahlul Bayt, or if one doesn't know a person like
very
Imam,
good point, yes,
well, he should be, you know, a prime candidate for, you know, causing problems,
yes, and as we've seen in other traditions,
and
yes,
you know, being very hostile towards other Islamic denominations.
True.
And yet
he didn't do that.
He does the opposite of that. He calls for Islamic unity.
Wonderful.
Because there's two aspects of that.
Please.
Of what he did. This is my analysis of it. Of course, sure. I'm sure there might be other analyses of why he was doing it. My analysis is that one was that it came out of the school of Ahlul Bayt, because we see that during the time of the presence of the imams.
Excellent.
They never try to
divide
the ummah.
They never did.
That even in the worst conditions, even when the khulafa were killing them and their families,
that's right,
they tried to maintain
the unity of the ummah.
Okay?
Very good.
And they realized that this is of, you know, supreme importance. And there's no point in, you know, the ummah breaking up and, you know, different denominations
or different groups
fighting each other and setting up rival this and that.
No.
So it comes directly as everything with imam. Out of the example and the sunnah of the Prophet and, you know, the imams of maintaining, you know, that unity. The second aspect of it is really this complete and total political astuteness and cleverness that Imam always had.
Yes. The wisdom that we were talking
about
before.
He was complete, and I'm talking about politically.
Yes.
You know, I mean, he had the greater wisdom, but he was also an extremely clever politician in terms of understanding tactically and strategically what needs to be done at what point.
Point, yes.
I would just want to make a little reference to another subject just to prove my bigger point.
Please do, yes.
Many people at the time of the revolution were insisting that the imperial army, that the Iranian army that was part of the Shah's regime should be dissolved.
Right.
An imam stood firm like a rock, saying it will not be dissolved, and that many of the soldiers and many of the officers are not part of the Shah's thinking and, you know, weren't killing people, and that this would be a great catastrophe for the country
if this army was dissolved,
if we dissolved the army. Not only that, he even wrote letters and spoke to the officers and said, you're part of us, you are, you know, you're our children, we're together in this. You know, you can be your own boss.
Wonderful.
This wasn't, you know, you don't need the American advisors. You yourself have the capabilities. Mm-hmm. And many people in the army at that time were actually quite religious. So this was they were trying to portray this image as the army being like the army of Turkey or Egypt, which is completely
irreligious. Yeah, but they had religious sympathies.
But most of the members of the army, whether it was Air Force or Army, the ground troops, or whether it was even the Navy, had religious backgrounds. And Imam knew this, and he was very clever in not doing this, because at that time you had many of these, you know, later we turned out like the, you know, these terrorists that are now, you know, going to...
Yes, you're referring to the MKO, aren't you?
Right. These terrorists that, alhamdulillah, thank God, no longer
exist now.
They were pressing Imam at that time, dissolve the army, we will be the new army.
Sure.
And can you imagine if that would have happened?
Oh my God.
Right. So this is part of the cleverness.
Yes.
The other part of the cleverness of Imam was, again, as we've talked about many times, understanding who the real and the main enemy is.
Yes.
The real and the main enemy at that time are and is America and Israel.
That's right.
And one of the ways in which they cause trouble is by
dividing
the Muslims.
Yes.
Sunni Shia,
creating tensions amongst
the Muslims.
Inter Shia,
inter Sunni,
yes.
Takfiri, this, that, whatever.
Sure.
And so when Imam, as this religious man that he is, as this person who is a complete, you know, representative and leader of the Shias, comes out and he forcefully talks about unity and Islamic unity.
Sure.
And not only does that in terms of his speech, but also does it in action.
In action, yes.
We see that when the Islamic Republic of Iran is established, where in the constitution it is mentioned that the official religion is the Ja'fari Madhab, where we talk about all the basis of the law being the Ja'fari law, and yet we also see that it is also a time where there's a renaissance of the Sunni population.
That's
and
right.
Areas that they live, in the sense that they are allowed to, and they practice their own madhab. They have their own courts, they have their own, you know, systems in terms of their personal law.
Sure.
Okay, they're not governed in personal law by the Ja'fari law, and they have representatives, and they're
in the parliament. Yes,
you know, they're part of the normal structure of the society.
Society, yes.
And yes,
along with other minorities.
And yes,
as
there
well.
Might have been from history and, you know, historically speaking, some deprivations in some of the areas, because they do live in marginal areas, for example, in the west or in the east. So
sure.
That's a different issue that has you know, actually very little to do with their denomination, more of a geographic and historic issue.
Yes.
But in terms of them being able to live in this Islamic Republic, in a dignified way, nobody doubts that. And they themselves are the best, you know, testament of that. And you know, you see what happened over the generations, the last 2-3 generations. You really see a marked improvement. And you know, many of the areas, especially if you look at the southeast in Balochistan, Sistan-Balochistan, you really had very high illiteracy rates before the revolution. And now literally everyone, there's schools, there's literacy, there's, you know, development in a way that was, you know, unimaginable years ago. All of it, you know, under the rule of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is based on the Imami school of Islam. So even within Iran, and, you know, they always try to bring in, like, side issues, like, oh, there, you know, in Tehran there's no, you know, Imam, you know, they don't have the Friday prayers for the Sunnis. Well, you know, you go in all the, in most of the cities where the Sunnis are the majority, you have Friday prayers which are you know, headed by the
sure.
by the Sunni
absolutely.
Denomination. And the Shias go there, and, you know, there's joint prayers, like you were saying.
Sure.
And, you know, these are not things that, you know, if people want to cause trouble, they can always find reasons to do that. But the
yes.
reality is completely different.
Yes.
This is on the national level. On the international level, we see that Imam immediately talks about, you know, supporting, for example, the Palestinians. Well,
that's
as
true.
We always say, are the Palestinians Shia or Sunni?
They're Sunni.
Well, they're Sunni.
Yes.
Okay? Mm. We're talking about, you know, Imam from the very beginning not allowing this, you know, evil cancer, whatever you want to call it,
sure.
to seep in into
yes.
the minds of people. And unfortunately, what we see, and this brings us to the situation we're currently in, and all the things we've discussed in terms of Syria and, you know, Ali Saud and Takfiris and so on, we see that, unfortunately, from the beginning, as it was during the time of the British, the main tool for causing division within the Muslim world are the Ahl Saud and the Takfiris.
Exactly.
By how? By declaring everybody else to be kafir.
Yes. Non-believers.
Non-believers. Every other Muslim except for us, according to them,
yes.
is a non-believer. That's why, because you were mentioning, you know, being bombed during prayer.
Sure.
Which Muslim would kill another Muslim during prayer?
During prayer. Exactly.
I mean, this is horrendous. It's completely reprehensible. I mean, this is something no Muslim would do to another mother, to
no.
another Muslim.
No.
I mean, imagine, you know, family feud arguments, you know, theological
sure.
disputes.
Sure.
Well, you know, one of the red lines of, you know, where you don't go is you don't kill people during prayer.
Exactly. But they crossed it.
Okay.
The Takfiris have crossed it.
So, you know, this is bad.
This is really bad.
Bad in the sense that, you know, you have now a legion of monsters of shayateen, you know, with big beards and, you know,
yes,
whatever.
Yeah,
you know, they have the shape of, and it's actually, you know what? It's actually, I would like to say it this way: they don't even look. They're a caricature of Islam.
Yes, they're a caricature of Islam. You're
okay.
right.
Okay, I mean, we have, you know, we have a tradition of having beards. You know, I have a beard.
Right? Yes, yes.
You know, the ulama, they usually have longer beards or whatever. I mean, this is part of the sunnah of the Prophet, and you know, so there's nothing wrong with having a beard.
Yeah.
But I mean, you just look at these guys, and they're caricatures.
Yes,
they don't look normal.
No.
They don't. You know, there's something wrong with them.
Something wrong with them. Yes.
You know, when we say extremist, you could just tell they're like,
there's something psychopathic about them. Yes.
So we don't even have them, because I was going to say we have these people who are supposedly the representatives of Islam, or they look Muslim. They actually don't really look Muslim.
No.
They look like a caricature of Islam.
Islam, yes.
Literally.
Literally, yes.
And they are portrayed as being, you know, the representative of Islam.
Mm.
You see in Syria, I mean, it's nuts. I mean, look at what they did in Syria.
Yeah, I know, it's horrendous.
And the ones that are funding the whole thing and wanting these guys to be the representative of Islam in the world and to wipe out everybody else are the Ahl Saud.
Yes.
And the reason the Ahl Saud want this is not because they have some sort of a deep attachment to the, you know, and love for, you know, Abdul Wahhab, you know, or Ibn Taymiyyah, or one of these guys who is supposedly the quote unquote scholars of the Takfiris,
yes.
right? Because you can't even call them scholars.
Scholars, no, right. you can't.
You can't really call them scholars.
No,
it's not that. It's not because they are, you know, holding up the flag of you know, pure Salaf Islam.
Yeah.
Because Salaf Islam doesn't kill other Muslims.
No, it doesn't.
Right?
No.
So it's really about using these and exploiting these ignorant people in order to stay in power.
Exactly. Exactly.
In Saudi Arabia in order to have control over the oil fields.
Sure.
Which is, you know, billions and billions. In order to have control over Mecca and Medina, which is billions and billions.
Billions, yes.
And this is all it's about.
Yes.
You know, neither King Abdullah nor any of the other, you know...
No, it's all about money and
old
power.
Guys and, you know, brothers and half-brothers and cousins and uncles. None of those guys care about, you know, pure Islam.
No, they don't. They care about power and money.
They care about Ali Saud staying in power, and they will do whatever it takes to do that. And if it takes them, you know, unleashing, you know, a legion of wacko, you know, terrorist organ eaters and, you know, cannibals and heart eaters.
Yes.
And, you know, people who will cut off heads with... I'm purposely mentioning the things they're doing. So
yes,
people
exactly.
realize what they're doing. I apologize.
They literally sawed the heads off.
They didn't saw that. No, no, brother. They didn't saw that. They used kitchen knives.
Kitchen.
Okay? And, you know, going around, for example, cutting the heads off priests.
Yes.
You know in Islam horrible. And in the Quran what it says?
Yes, I know.
It says we have to protect the churches.
Yes, we have to protect the people of the book.
We have all the riwayat that talk about, you know, us, you know.
We are not allowed to
we're
do
not
touch them,
this is not,
violate
they are
them
not
in any
kafir.
Shape or form.
They're not kafir in the sense of being
no,
kafir
they're
harbi.
Not.
They're not. We're not in war against them. They're living under the protection of Islam and Muslims. You're not allowed to do this, you crazy person.
Mm.
You have to respect them. And yet they do it.
They do it. So that shows the real evil nature.
It shows that they are not Muslim. They don't understand Islam.
No.
They don't know the Quran. They
no.
don't know anything.
No, they don't.
Okay? They're just there to
create
help
chaos.
The Saudis and the Israelis cause division.
Exactly.
So, having said all that,
yes.
we get to the current times.
Mm.
Well, we see that the Supreme Leader, may God protect him,
yes, please.
Continuing the line of Imam, talking about that we have to maintain Islamic unity. So many years now he's been talking about Islamic unity. At a time when others weren't even talking about it, he was talking about that we should have Islamic
sure.
unity.
Sure, yes.
He's talking about the fact that this division, Sunni Shia divisions, are the making of the enemies of Islam. And it's very interesting. Again, you have a person like the Supreme Leader, again, Ayatollah Khamenei, you know, a leader of the Shias. He's from the, you know, Imami school. And he talks about that it's takfiris, mainly on the so-called, he says they call themselves Sunni, but they're not Sunni. And then he says there's even some on the Shia side.
Yes.
He talks about them. That,
this
you know,
kind of extremism.
This kind of extremism and you know, takfirism, whatever you want to call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, from the Shia side.
Coming from the Shia side and condemning it.
Yes.
And not only condemning it, but issuing the fatwas that are required to condemn it. Talking about not cursing, you know, the personalities that are important to the different denominations.
Exactly.
Talking about unity, okay?
Sure.
So it's not simply, you know, rhetoric. It's actually action.
No. It's also education, isn't it, as well? Because he's educating us as how to be brothers with one another.
Exactly. Because this is what Islam is.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's what it's all about.
Right. Mm. And the point is simply this. The differences that we might have pale in comparison to the dangers we face from the enemies.
And the enemy, yes, that's true.
Okay?
Yeah.
This is the point.
Mm.
Nobody is trying to, you know, compromise on our deep-held beliefs. And, you know, everybody knows how much we love the Ahlul Bayt and how much we consider them to be the way in
which... The best examples for us to follow.
And the way in which we can, you know, get close to God.
Get close to God and understand Islam, of
Because
course.
They are the ones that teach us real Islam.
Yes.
Okay? They're the ones that tell us, you know, this is our basic belief as Imami Muslims.
Absolutely.
Is that we have thaqalain, we have Quran, and we have Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
And they're together.
They're together, yes.
Okay, and if you don't have one, then you don't have Islam.
Exactly.
So if you don't have Quran, but you have Ahlul Bayt, you don't have Islam. If you have Ahlul Bayt, if you have Ahlul Bayt and you don't have Quran, you don't have Islam.
Exactly.
So, you know, this is our belief. So nobody's trying to compromise on that or trying to, you know, step
back. No, that's not what it's about.
But you have to look at the same Ahlul Bayt and how they behaved?
Exactly.
Number
That's
one.
The point,
number
yes.
two, you have to also be clever.
Mm.
And you have to understand who the real enemy is.
Yes.
And so this is why, because then people might say, well, you always keep going on about Ali Saud and, you know, takfiris and, well, aren't you doing exactly that? Well, our point in all these is that they are one of the greatest barriers to Islamic unity.
This is the problem.
Because they are neither Sunni nor Shia.
No. They are the enemies of
They are
Islam.
Not a denomination of Islam.
The enemies of
they
Allah.
They look like, you know, they are Islamic, although, like I said, they
They're
look
a
like
caricature
caricatures of Islam,
Islam.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about, you know, well, why, if you're saying all this and then you're going ending up attacking the Takfiris. Well, the Takfiris don't even consider us Muslim, so why should we?
Yeah, exactly. You know? I mean, this is the point. Yes.
So we don't consider them to really be Muslim.
No.
Because no Muslim does these things. It's not simply about saying it with your tongue.
No.
It's not about just, you know, saying Shahadatain.
No, it's all on video. It's all on the internet.
It's not just about saying Shahadatain.
No.
Okay, so you say Shahadatain, and then you end up doing everything which is against, you know, the
I mean,
the most basic principles of Islam. So how can you say that that person is a Muslim?
Exactly.
Just because they have a beard?
Sure.
Just because they say Allahu Akbar?
No, I mean, the thing is, this is what I was saying in one program myself on this subject, on the very subject of Takfiris. I was suggesting that, you know, I mean, we're talking about democracy and talking about systems of government that give quality of life, progression to its people. But what are we going to get with if the Takfiris are in power? We have to eat the liver of our neighbors? I mean, is that the way we're going to carry on?
Well, I think this is what has become so painfully clear in Syria.
Yeah.
Is they were trying to portray this as, you know, the Sunni masses rising up against the evil Alawi dictatorship and the Shia dictatorship.
Sure.
And the majority of Sunnis were like, hey, wait a second. You know, we don't want to be...
with them.
No, we're not with them.
No, no.
Okay?
Because I don't want to eat my neighbor
this
tomorrow.
Is not what Sunni Islam is.
Yes.
Okay? Mm. This is a problem that we've had over the last 100 years, is that these Takfiris and these so-called Salafis and Wahhabis, and, you know, there's even distinctions between them.
Them as well, yes, true.
Right? Within them, there's even different grades and shades, right?
Sure.
But let's just call it Wahhabis and Takfiris. Mm. The problem we've had is they were successful in claiming that they're Sunnis, and yet they're not Sunnis.
No.
They don't speak for the Sunnis.
No, they don't.
And it has to do with the fact that many of the Sunnis in the last 100 years were at a very low level of understanding of religion.
Yes.
In terms of literacy, and it has to go with the civilizational decline that existed in the Muslim world.
That's right.
It has to do with the fact that you had imperial powers coming in. You really didn't have good teachers of Islam.
No.
I'm not saying there were none. There were some.
Yeah.
But the level was low. And so when you had this funding and this movement coming out of Saudi Arabia with all that oil money
and all that
support by the Americans and the British, they were able to
hijack
a lot of the Sunni mosques and centers and so on.
You know, even this al-Nusra front at the moment in Syria, you know, who are the caricatures of Islam as you described it, even they're killing each other, you know, even within their own groupings as well. That even that there are several groups that are supposed to be in the Free Syrian Army, but it's neither free nor Syrian,
nor an army,
and they're killing all, you know, each other as well.
Right.
So I mean, what, that's the thing. What are you going to get at the end of the day?
It's a dead end.
It's a dead end.
You know, this is because there's no reality, you know, as the basis of it. This is why you have the movements that happened, for example, in Iran, or you have movements such as Hezbollah, which happened in Lebanon, you know, being successful in the long run, because they're based on reality. They're based on truth.
Yes.
They're based on Islam, which is according to the Quran, according to the Sunnah.
Principles of the Quran,
okay?
Yes, absolutely.
And these Takfiris are not according to the Quran and the Sunnah. They are the opposite of the Quran and Sunnah.
Exactly.
And believe me, this is the important point, and I really hope that the listeners, you know, can take this away from what we're saying.
Thank you for that.
When we say that the Takfiris are not based on Islam, that doesn't mean we're saying they're not Sunnis.
No.
Because if you look at Sunnis, the four madhahib, the different scholars, you know, they have a lot of, you know, the basis is Quran, the basis is the hadith and the riwayat that exist in that school.
Sure.
And they're much closer to the reality of Islam than anything, you know, comparable to it. So don't be fooled. Don't let them say that we are Sunnis. Takfiris are not Sunnis.
No.
Okay?
No.
On the other hand, and I would want to emphasize this, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we have some, and I will clearly say it, mercenaries, some people who are paid by the Americans and the British, who put on, you know, Shia clothing, and they have Shia names, and they have Shia programs on TV and on satellite stations, and they are just as bad as these Takfiris, because their Takfiris in the other direction.
Yes, right.
Now, of course, they don't send, you know, armies into Syria to cut out the hearts of
people.
But
it's very damaging.
They're part of the same plan and game.
Game.
You have these extremists on this side trying to provoke and trying to, you know, going into Shia towns, for example, and killing, you know, kids and women and whatever, you know, desecrating graves. I mean, what Muslim would go and, you know, break open the grave of a Sahaba of the Prophet?
Prophet. I mean, this is ridiculous.
Why would you do that?
Yeah.
So who cares if he was friends with Ali or not? He's Sahaba of the Prophet.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
Why would you do that?
Mm.
What Muslim would do that?
Okay.
No, it's unthinkable.
So that's on. Then you have on the other side, you have the Shia mercenaries, the so-called, whatever, the Takfiri Shias, you know?
Right.
Stoking the
flames of division.
Right.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, this is this, and
yeah,
calling
and,
people
and
names.
Cursing and swearing for no reason.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm.
Which is forbidden in Islam.
Against the fatwa of all the Maraji.
Al Maraji, yes.
Okay.
They're not allowed to do that.
When the things were getting out of hand in Iraq, they asked Ayatollah Sistani, may God protect him.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, they asked him, are the Sunnis our brothers? And he said, they're not only not your brothers, they're your heart and soul.
My God.
This is what he told his followers. He said, they're not only your brothers, they're your heart
and soul.
You have to sacrifice yourself for them.
For them.
This is the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Exactly.
Okay? And people are seeing it.
Mm.
People are seeing this. I'm talking about the Sunnis.
Yes.
I'm talking about the majority of Sunnis. I'm talking about the Arabs, you know, of the different, whether it's Sunnis or Christians. They're seeing what the reality is.
Gosh.
They're not getting fooled by the Saudis and by their, you know, crazy
their vicious
creatures
propaganda,
and,
yes,
and you know,
yes.
all these guys who come on TV and just spew hate and,
yeah,
and division.
It is. They're spewing
and just
hatred,
remember
yes.
this, mm. after all is said and done, mm-hmm. who benefits? Who benefits?
Israel.
And it's clear that Israel and America and the enemies of Islam benefit from
of
these divisions.
So
why would you
international community, isn't
why,
it?
Why would you do something that benefits Israel and America?
Exactly.
Against your fellow Muslim.
Exactly.
Why would you do that?
Mm. Really?
So alhamdulillah, these things are being said.
Yes, exposed.
Alhamdulillah, the majority of brothers and sisters
are beginning to see
of
now
the different, of different
yeah, the reality.
They're also seeing the reality of Shias, that the Shias are not, you know, these extremists, that
no.
they are, you know, mushrik, whatever,
no.
all the
And that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, was quite right about what he was saying at that, at, you know, 35
right.
years ago, that yeah. this is going to be
because,
a major
because
problem.
We've shown with our action in the last 30, you know, 5 years, what we say, we also deliver with our action. We stick to our friends. We are not extremists. We want everybody to live peacefully.
Sure.
We don't discriminate based
That's
on,
right.
on denomination. And this is the way of Ahlul Bayt. This is the way of Imam Ali alayhi salam. This is the way of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. This is the way of Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Absolutely.
This is who we follow because they are the ones that
May
teach
God
us real
them.
Islam.
Yes.
And it's good. I'm happy because things are moving in this direction.
That's right.
And the key is going to be the Arab populations.
Mm.
This is why the Saudis are freaking out.
Freaking out.
They're freaking out.
Even with the Muslim Brotherhood, in spite of all the mistakes they were making, they couldn't even tolerate them because they knew that what big a threat this is to their power.
It all comes down to the Arab populations being, you know, becoming familiar with real Islam.
Yes.
Looking at the real Sunnah of the
That's
Prophet.
Right.
Looking at, you know, great Arab personalities and leaders, the greatest Arab ever, Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Islam, of course.
Right?
Of course.
Right? So this is not something that, you know,
very nicely put.
It's their own heritage.
It is their own heritage.
It's their own. It's
Excellent
not like some
point,
Ajami,
yes.
whatever, Majusi
no, it's their
thing
heritage.
Being, you know, when we're talking about Imam Ali alayhi salam, we're talking about, you know, we're talking about the noblest of noble Arabs.
Arabs.
You know?
My God.
Bani Hashim,
exactly.
Okay? So, you know, this is something that, you know, alhamdulillah, through the efforts of media to a certain extent, through the realities that people have seen
in the on way, the ground, yes.
The way Iran has behaved, the way, for example, the successes that Hezbollah has had, the changes that have occurred in Iraq.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
People are waking up. Mm. And this is why the Saudis are completely freaking out. This is why the Israelis are completely freaking out.
Yes.
Because they know that once the Arabs become familiar with
the true teachings of Islam,
with the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
And again, please, let me be very clear about this. It's not about labels.
No.